So as you know, we have a test coming up next Tuesday, and I just wanted to go over tips for how to study for that. It's exactly the same format as test number one and test number two, so that should be familiar at this point. Slide identification, those images are up on the website, larryspeck.com, so just familiarize yourself with them. People did really well on that segment last time. The multiple choice questions, there will be eight of those, and four of them will be from the book, and four of them will be from the lectures. Let me just give you a few tips on how I would study the book for those multiple choice questions. There are four particular things I suggest you look at. Those first chapters about Santa Barbara and Edgartown, those are really critical for you to understand. And in particular, the thing that's important to understand is what makes each of those a very particular place. How do we identify a whole community as a place? And this is a huge difference between just kind of anonymous placelessness, where in fact, in terms of human factors, we feel less identification of community. We feel less groundedness in a place that seems generic, anonymous, unidentifiable. What is it in Edgartown and Santa Barbara in their physical architectural configurations that made them seem like a place, made them really powerful as communities? And both of these are, over decades and decades, they have been very, very tight-knit, popular communities. What is it in the physical environment that did that? This is very related to what we're talking about in terms of humanism at a larger scale, but it's dealt with in a slightly different way in those first two chapters of The Place of Houses. The second thing is, in the lecture on designation and organization of use, one of the things I mentioned as a reason why we designate and organize uses is because we have machines in buildings, and they become very much a part of human factors, of how we use environments. And that's actually a kind of a late 19th century, 20th century notion. And in the chapter in The Place of Houses called The Order of Machines, they really talk about the role of machines in particular in homes, how having machines affected the kind of use and organization of homes. And even in terms of their aesthetic, and they in particular talk about a phrase from one of Le Corbusier's books where he talks about a home being a machine for living in. And they use the example of the Villa Savoye by Le Corbusier, and they talk a lot about that. This whole notion of what's the relationship between 20th, 21st century machines and the impact of the way we use buildings. That's, again, an important thing to look for in The Place of Houses. A third thing is, this is an interesting book because they use a lot of their own work as examples. So this is the people who wrote this book, Charles Moore, Gerald Allen, Donald Linden, all three of those are practicing architects. They're also academics. Charles Moore was dean at Yale and head of the department at UCLA and taught here at UT for 10 years. Donald Linden was chairman of the department at MIT, chairman of the department at Berkeley. Actually saw Donald in California a week ago. These are people who are heavily involved in practice, but also very thoughtful academic people and, you know, wrote this book. But it's interesting to see, well, how do they actually apply these ideas in their work? So there are a number of places throughout the whole book that they talk about their own work. But in particular, that last chapter called Epilogue is really a kind of, was written actually years after the original book was written, and reflecting back on their work since that book. And one of the houses there is Charles Moore's own house here in Austin that he built during the time he was teaching here at UT. So that's right here, hometown building. It's important to understand how did these architects employ these ideas in making the buildings they designed, and how did that play out in particular in Charles Moore's house here in Austin. So I would pay particular attention to that. And then the fourth thing, and I've mentioned this in previous books too, in particular Experiencing Architecture, pay particular attention to those examples that are by architects that we looked at in class, or we've looked at a lot in class. So, for example, we looked at the University of Virginia by Thomas Jefferson last time in the lecture. They spend a lot of time on Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's house that he designed for himself in Virginia. De La Savoie, that's by Le Corbusier. We've talked about Le Corbusier and probably looked at five or six buildings in class. These are important things to pay attention to. There are buildings there by Mies van der Rohe that we've talked about a good bit in class. There are buildings there by Alvar Aalto that we've talked about a good bit in class. Pay particular attention when it's an architect whose work we've looked at in class. Okay, those are my four tips for how to study for the place of houses. Okay, so last time we were talking about meaning in architecture, a slightly different take on human factors. Now not looking at the function or convenience or friendship formation or patterns of living or any of those kinds of things like we'd looked at before, but now looking at architecture as a way of conveying ideas, a means of communication. How do we use architecture to transfer messages within our own time or even from one era to another era? How do we communicate what the values, the interests, the character of that society was by embodying that in architecture? And so I ask you in your Twitter card question to give me an example that you could think of a building that conveys meaning. And here's some of the results. Someone says, I think the whole city of Washington, D.C. does a really good job of portraying the message of what America is about. A specific building that comes to mind is the Lincoln Memorial. The monument does a great job of symbolizing the accomplishments of Lincoln. The large scale of the building and the largeness of the Lincoln statue highlight its historical prestige. It's a highly elevated building that looks over all of D.C., which helps solidify the importance of the monument and the person it represents. Fantastic example, and a really good example of literal direct communication. Here is this big-ass statue of Abraham Lincoln, looking up the mall. Very, very powerful communication about the importance of Lincoln in our history. But then also some abstract communication, as pointed out here, just the scale, the location, the grandeur, all elevate that whole era and the ideas he stood for and the importance of abolition of slavery, all of those things that then have provoked things like the huge civil rights marches in the 1960s. They were there at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. That was the place to make that point, because the building's making the point, because it's creating communication that says this was an important year in our history and something fundamental occurred here. And then when somebody else wants to make a speech or have an event that communicates a similar message, that spot, that powerful communication of a physical environment is important to reinforce their message. Someone else says, I first went to a small United Methodist church that had the typical steeple and stained glass windows. It reminds me directly of tradition and wearing a dress on Sunday. Today I go to a church in a high school gym with no dress code. It sends the opposite message. But indirectly, it shows that you don't have to be in a special place to feel a connection with God. That is really, really a good observation. What is the difference in the communication of a church that is in a traditional church building and the communication of a church that's in a high school gym? Those buildings communicate something about that church and its values and what religion means and what connection to God means. Is it something you do in a revered place at a special moment? Or is it just, it's just everyday life. You can do it anywhere. And the building communicates those spiritual and religious ideas. Somebody else says, I'm from a very small town called Taylor, Texas. And the football field in my hometown seems to be very meaningful to the community. The field communicates with us and reminds us all of our hometown pride. On Friday nights, the field communicates even louder with all the excitement. Another just great example, everyday, common, Texas, small town example, but very, very powerful meaning. Somebody else says, the Sydney Opera House communicates a message of thrill and entertainment in respect to its unique shapes. You can almost expect the quality of the shows and concerts presented here to be unique and awe-inspiring as the building itself is. Someone else says, the Twin Towers, I believe, fell under abstract communication. The way they ripped through the sky emphasized America's power and their importance in the global economy. They were two of the most iconic buildings in the U.S., not only because of what happened inside of the towers, but because of what they represented. Now, that one is an incredible, great example of making this point. When someone wanted to destroy America and global economy, what did they choose to do to make the point that they hated America and they hated a globalized economy? They targeted those buildings because those buildings said absolutely in your face, as clearly as possible, look how strong America is. Look at these big damn towers that just defy gravity and are not timid at all. They're bold and they're in your face. And they're emblematic of world trade, our role in a globalized economy. And when somebody wanted to fight that, they wanted to destroy that global economy and America's role in that, those buildings were the target because they said it more clearly, more loudly, more prominently than anything else. Someone else says, the Hoover Dam is a massive structure that conveys dominance over nature and the ability for humans to control their surroundings. The dam incorporated clean lines and structure with walls stretching to the sky as if to show the sky's the limit. It was built during a time when dams were king in the United States, politically, economically, and they represented innovations in engineering. Someone else says, the church that was connected to my elementary school was very emotive of a church, but on a very small scale. The elements of a traditional church were downplayed with modest stained glass and scale. The light stone exterior felt like it wanted to be cozy and familiar. The interior was entirely wood paneling with hand-sewn quilts depicting the Beatitudes. This exuded a warmth that communicated the small, family-like community of the parish, but it still emphasized spirituality and humility. Finally, someone says, when I was in Washington, D.C., I visited the Vietnam War Memorial. At that time, I was too young to know what the Vietnam War was or what happened there, but it definitely communicated desolation with its vast black stone walls and so many names carved on its face. It absolutely communicated desolation and remembrance, and it even reflected your own face in its surface. Those were really good observations, and they make the point very well that architecture has the ability from the scale of a freaking high school football field in a small town to the World Trade Center that is an emblem globally, to communicate messages and meaning and to make people feel some symbolic representation of values or ideas they hold dear. So today we're looking at a synthesis of all of these different topics we've been looking at in terms of human factors. So as we did in the earlier lecture on form, we're going to be sort of taking several buildings and looking at the way that they incorporate many different aspects of human factors. And in the end, synthesize a kind of success in terms of being buildings that are reflective of the behaviors and the uses and the functions and the meanings that are associated with them. The first building we're going to be looking at is right here in Austin. And it is the Austin Bergstrom International Airport. This is a building that was built in 1999. We mentioned in an earlier lecture that there was an old airport at Mueller because of acoustical problems and the impact that was having on the community. There was a lawsuit. The federal government required that the city of Austin build a new airport. That's a big, big task to undertake for a city. So a new site was identified, and a new start-from-scratch airport was built and completed in 1999. I think that's right. Let's just walk through these various topics we've investigated in terms of human factors. The first thing we talked about was designation and organization of uses. How does that impact the design of an airport? And absolutely, really, really important in the design of an airport, because there are huge issues in an airport that have to be dealt with that are make or break in terms of this kind of function. So, for example, safety is a very, very important issue. There's all kinds of crazy, dangerous things that go on at airports. There's fueling up these airplanes with very toxic jet fuel. There's enormous noise of the airplanes coming in and kind of deafening sound that occurs there. And yet you're trying to get thousands and thousands of people in proximity to all these things. So how do you separate the kind of dangerous and mechanical and functional parts that happen on the apron and happen around putting the bags on the planes and happen around fueling the planes and stocking the planes? And how do you make that compatible with everyday people with little children and they're trying to get on the plane? And it's really kind of a phenomenal thing how in an airport all those things that are conflicting with each other get orchestrated in a way that it's safe and convenient for everyone. And we talked about that's a major reason for organizing, designating uses, is it's practical. We need to do that just to make things work. So in the Austin airport, there's a very clear delineation, a line that goes right through here. And on this side is the air side of the airport. And on this side is the land side of the airport. And there's all those functions that have to do with ticketing and baggage claim and all those things that are kind of not secure and are really public oriented. And then there is this security boundary right there. And that's not only safety, but it's also security so that you screen people so that anybody who might want to do something horrible is not able to take arms or any kind of explosives or anything else beyond a certain point. So that delineation of airside and landside is from a practical point of view of just those functions that are kind of industrial and those functions that are more people-oriented. But it also is a way of separating the secure and the non-secure side of the airport. So half of the building has one kind of character. The other half of the building has the other kind of character. And there's this clear delineation between those two parts. And that happens in section as well as in plan. So on the air side of the airport, that's where all of the gates are and the embarking and disembarking from the airplanes, and then all the services that go with that, concessions and restrooms and things like that. And the architectural character of that is really about sending you up in the sky, big, high spaces, tons of light that comes in, lots of view to the sky, a kind of character and quality of space that has to do with that activity that goes on there. And then on this side, which is the more public and less secure side, then it's that's where you pick up your bags, that's where you greet your friends. It's got a much more intimate feeling in here. It connects to a whole industrial area back here, which is where the bags are taken off the airplane and delivered to you in baggage claim. It's also where, from the ticketing areas here, the bags are sent down there and put onto the airplane and sent out to the airfield on that side. So that's a very clear functional delineation, organization and designation of different spaces. So as you come into the airport, you come in two spots here, actually three spots, one, two, three, and then you come into that sort of public concourse, and then you go through security boundaries at those three spots. And you get into now this long area of the gates and the disembarking on the airplane. And then when you come back, you come to those gates like that, and you go back to those three points that take you back to the non-secure side of the airport. Now, the second lecture we talked about was this notion of architectural determinism. So, all right, you've got all of the functions in all the right places, but now how do you actually help people use that? Try to influence their behavior so that it's as amenable, it's as easy, it's as comfortable as it possibly can be. And a lot of airports are actually extremely stressful environments. So one of the explicit goals in this airport was to reduce that stress, to make people feel comfortable. Now, if you can actually affect people's feelings like that, that's a phenomenal kind of architectural determinism. How can we make people feel a little more comfortable, a little less stressed out here? And one of the goals was what the architects called intuitive wayfinding, that I always know where I am. One of the great insecurities at an airport is thinking, will I get to my plane on time? Where is my gate? Just this kind of tension around the deadline of getting to that plane and getting on it on time. So in the Austin airport, there is this notion where you come to the front door there, you see in that glass very open from the outside, it's very transparent exactly where the ticketing is and where all the things are on the inside. Then once you get in that front door, right at that moment, which is right here, or right here, you can see everything you need in the airport. You can see straight ahead of you the security that's right there. You can see down below the baggage claim where people pick up their bags. You can see in front of you the concessions where you might need to pick up a magazine or get some chewing gum. You can see beyond that the gates themselves out here. So just from that one point, I can see ticketing over there, I can see baggage claim here, I can see security, I can see concessions, and I can see the gates. And there's just this comforting feeling that I know how to negotiate this. Intuitively, I can get there. Now, that's a completely different thing than what you find at many airports, which is this kind of rabbit warren, this maze of corridors and passages, and you have to follow this sign. Let's see, gates 23 to 37, baggage claim, ground transportation, and you're constantly just sort of being funneled, but you don't know where you are, how long it's going to take, where your destination is. If you can make that intuitive, if you can comfort people by letting them see transparently where they're going, then it can make their experience much more comfortable. Again, this kind of just openness of the whole space, not mysterious, not something where you don't know what's coming ahead of you. That's a security that you can get and feel more comfortable as you move through the airport. Then when you get past security, even the shape of that space, that big arc shape, it lets you know there's a center and there are ends. You come in the center, you can see the distribution one way or the other way. When you come off the airplane, intuitively, we would know that maybe the passage out is in the middle. So we go toward that center and head that direction, and that, in fact, will reward you with the way out of the building. So all of that is a way of just giving this sense of how to move, how to negotiate. And then always, when you walk out off the airplane, where are the bathrooms? Right there in front of you. Where's the concessions? Right there where I can see it. Those kinds of things you need after getting off an airplane, they're available, they're visible. That's a very comforting thing. And then just the visibility of that baggage claim area. In most airports, it's like in the basement somewhere, and you get down there and it's in kind of a squished space. And whereas this one's open and airy, and you can see where you're going, and you can see how far it is and how you get there. Okay, so architectural determinism, that's a big part of the design of this airport too. The third lecture, we were beginning to talk about humanism at a smaller scale. So what are there, how are there ways in an airport? This is a big building, and this is thousands of people in this building. In some ways, it can be kind of dehumanizing and intimidating to be in an airport. How can you break the scale down? And in the Austin airport, there's lots of ways they've attempted to do this. In that big space where all the gates are off of that, it is important for it to be light and airy and open and high ceilings and big view of the sky, so you don't feel so claustrophobic if the ceilings are low, where you got thousands of people and you're in a tight space. The openness is really important. So it needs to have that larger scale. But then it's broken down into a smaller scale so that the concessions are like little smaller buildings inside this larger space, and bring it down to a human scale. Austin Airport is one of the few anywhere that has live music, so there's a live music stage in the center of the airport, and that's another way of kind of humanizing it, bringing it down to a smaller scale. And then all over in the airport, there are artworks that are a way of having a smaller, more intimate human connection. This one is one by a local artist, Fidencio Duran. There are actually 9 panels of this that are over the American Airlines ticket booth on the west side of the airport. And it's a really sweet scene. It's a Hispanic family having a picnic in their backyard. And they're throwing the frisbee, and they're playing with the dogs, and they're barbecuing, and there's just something humane and gentle and warm about that kind of message and that kind of content and that kind of scale in this airport. On the other side by the Southwest counter, there's an equally interesting mural that's done by a guy named Thomas Evans, and it's of landscape in Central Texas. So it's connecting you to the community here in Texas, but it also is breaking down the scale and making it humane at that smaller scale. There are many elements within that larger kind of monumental space that break it down. Things like the signage, things like this little area outside the concessions where it's almost like sidewalk cafe, and you've got lights that are almost like outside street lights, and you've got tables and chairs that are like sitting on a patio. So it doesn't seem an intimidating scale. It seems a friendly scale because it's broken down into that smaller scale. And even at a much, much smaller level, the handrail here. So it's, this is an airport's a building that gets a lot of abuse. Lots of people, baggage that bangs up against things that has to be bulletproof. So yes, it's a steel handrail and it's pretty stout. But then when it comes to the part that you touch, the actual grab rail for your hand, it's not an industrialized piece of steel like those. It actually is a hand-wrought piece of steel that a craftsman here in Austin named Lars Stanley, handcrafted for that moment where you touch the handrail. Again, an example of humanism at a smaller scale. Then we had that lecture on humanism at a larger scale. How do you enrich an environment by giving it a kind of civic quality and embody these ideas of humanism, but at a larger scale? And we talked about things like convenience, and that certainly is here in the airport. When you walk off the airplane, is there a bathroom? Because I've been needing to take a pee for 45 minutes, and the freaking seatbelt sign was on, and I couldn't get up, and I need a bathroom. Well, there are bathrooms all over. Right the minute you get out, right there, there's a bathroom. Easy to find, easy to locate. When you're waiting for your flight and you'd like to get a meal or you'd like to get a book to read, or are there concessions there frequently and conveniently? Yeah, all over. Excellent convenience in the airport. Another thing we talked about was the range of people accommodated. And oh my God, an airport is a place where there's every kind of human being. Old people, young people, rich people, poor people, every ethnicity you can imagine. It really does have that feeling of a larger community that's in the airport. Other things that we talked about in humanism at a larger scale, we were talking about signs of human presence. And all over in the airport, there are little, interesting little bits of human presence. And this is another piece of artwork that's actually in the baggage claim area. Gorgeous piece of artwork where the artist is, it's like they're bags that you opened up at the baggage claim level. And on the left here, we have somebody's hanging bag, and it's just showing us all the personal items that are in there and making us feel some kind of intimate connection with a traveler with that bag. And it's a very Austin kind of bag. It's got things in it that would relate to this city. And on the right is a guitar case. Again, the sort of music scene in Austin, and you've got all the postcards that somebody sent them, and you've got their other accoutrements of their music that are expressed in the artwork here. This is signs of human presence, that communication of some human being investing themselves and expressing that in this element of the building. Another thing we talked about there was periodic natural relief. My God, in an airport, you can't have a lot of nature because there's all this kind of industrial stuff that has to happen. There are cars and buses and taxis and airplanes and jet fuel and cargo. But there is, hollowed out at the airport at the entrance, little gardens that give that periodic natural relief. Again, an important element in making humanism at a larger scale. And that's just replete throughout the airport. This is other piece of artwork by Sandy Fedoric that's really about aviation, kind of the history of aviation, a little storytelling up there. And then just signs of human presence of just lots of people and food and outdoor activity and cafe kind of environment, those things that enrich and make humane an environment at a larger scale. There are these little display cases. That's one of my favorite things in the airport. This was at the early stages of the airport, and they hadn't mastered how to handle them very well. But now they're freaking genius. So they allow organizations in town to have little displays about what they contribute to the community. So in this case, it was Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center. Right now, there's an exhibit up at the Umloff Sculpture Garden, this sculpture garden with works of Charles Umloff, who was this famous sculptor who taught here at UT, and there's a museum to his work here in Austin, and all those little jewel box display cases are full of Charles Umloff work right this minute. One of my very favorite exhibits in there, several years ago, they had one of church ladies' hats. So African-American women who went to Baptist churches in East Austin got together and made an exhibit of the hats they wear to church. And these were a hoot. There were these elaborate, gorgeous church lady hats. And this is just the architects putting this little exhibit space in there and allowing the community to express themselves in that. And letting us see, that was really an eye-opener to me. I don't freaking go to Baptist Church in East Austin. I don't see the church ladies. But, man, I really enjoyed seeing those hats. Those were really cool. And there's always a display of something you didn't know about in your community. That's little bits of signs of human presence that can make a more humane environment at a larger scale. The music in the slide on the right, that's another way of making a more humane environment at a larger scale, making a performance stage, you know, making a place where something can happen besides just waiting on your damn airplane and being bored. It's a combination of activity. That was another one of those elements that make a more humane environment. In the final lecture, this section, we were talking about meaning and how does the Austin Airport incorporate that notion of meaning? And there really was an explicit attempt to say, this is the Austin Airport. This is not a generic airport. It's about our community. And in fact, the mayor and the city council appointed a 30-person committee to work with the architects and to help them make something that would express the nature and character of Austin. And so there are 10 or 15 things in the airport that were meant to communicate meaning. What is this community about? For a visitor, for somebody who lives here, how do we express our community? One of the things in the slide on the left is the building is made out of substantially this local granite. So this is something that's just here and in our geology. Central Texas is the second largest source of building stone in the United States. Our geology is really great for that. So the airport is inside, outside, really full of all of this, this interesting, very characterful granite. And the slide on the right, we're also have long been a high-tech community. And so the building is meant to seem kind of technologically visible. Like Tinker Toys that you can put together and take apart. Interesting, complex structural systems. And in the new addition that's just been made to the airport, a kind of different play than in the original part of the airport on how structural systems, how technical things inspire architecture, because that's a value of this community. That granite is carved in the baggage claim area in the slide on the left. Into these little glyphs that are actually big, but in the scale of that baggage claim area, they're kind of details. But they actually represent the trees in Central Texas. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that the east-west streets in Austin were originally named for trees of Central Texas. So it takes those 14 trees and it shows leaves and seed pods of these trees. And then those are keyed to terrazzo murals in the floor that show that original grid of Austin and all the north-south streets named for the rivers and all the east-west streets named for the trees. And then there's another mural over there that shows all those rivers in Texas. And then on the walls, there are the trees of Texas represented there. So a little history lesson of Austin's origins and this reverence for nature and for trees and for rivers, all depicted in the architectural surfaces of that space in the baggage claim. You're sitting there waiting for your freaking bag. You have nothing else to do. You might as well kind of look around, and there's a little brochure there, and you can read the history. And so it's a way of having some meaning, some communication in the airport. Now, the net result of all of those things is that this is an airport that has been extremely successful in terms of user experience. The people who go through that airport really appreciate that airport. There is an international organization of airport managers, and they do polls every year, and they rank the airports according to user satisfaction. And every single year since this building was built in 1999, it has ranked within the top five in the nation in terms of user satisfaction. So of all the airports in the country, this is one of the ones that consistently ranks very high in terms of people saying, yeah, I like this airport, I like using this airport. And internationally, in its range of size, it has always ranked in the top three among international airports of a certain size. So it's right up there with, I think it's Reykjavik or something like that, but there are a few in Europe that are also extremely user-friendly like this and have that same kind of reputation. Now, honestly, that's an extraordinary accomplishment, I think, for architects to shoot for. Do we really make an environment that someone in a potentially tense environment of going to an airport, usually airports are not people's favorite architectural experience, but if you can make it in a way that it really supports human life there, that it really enhances that experience, that's an important architectural achievement. Okay, second building. This one is a library in Delft in the Netherlands. It's for the Delft Technical University, and the architects are Mekanu. Mekanu is at the time they did this, they were a relatively young firm. Now they're a very exciting, very interesting firm that's doing work all over the world. But they're a Dutch firm, so this was in their own backyard. And it was a very challenging situation where they wanted to build a new library right in the center of the campus. But the campus was full. They didn't have a site, really. And so there was one kind of green space in the center that everyone really enjoyed, and it was an important amenity for the campus, but it also seemed to be the obvious place to put the library. So the architects tried to maintain the usability and the function of that green space by tucking the building under the green space and just letting it kind of rise up on the side and get the light and exposure that it needed. But it was a way of double using that space as an outdoor green space that then becomes a green roof for the building itself. So the very first move there is trying to accommodate a lot of activities that are already there, and all these new activities that need to be housed on the site as well. So in fact, there are sort of three sides of the building that get exposure there. And then one side of the building that really becomes just a slope that makes a kind of hill at the center of the campus. On those three sides are faculty offices and a huge computer lab and things that needed exposure to the outside. And then the green trees that were originally on that space are there to look out into. So it's a very nice view. And then on the inside is this big library space. And here are their faculty offices that have the glass on the outside, and then they have glass on the inside as well. So you get that light view that comes through to the big library space, which is also skylit in the center of the building there. And it's, in terms of organization and designation of uses, it's complicated. This was a crazy program. Tons of faculty offices. And they did that because they really wanted the faculty where the students are. So rather than the faculty being off in a separate departmental building somewhere, they wanted the faculty to be in that space where students are coming to study. They wanted the faculty to be there as well. So they have all these faculty offices there. They have a huge computer lab and resource space that they also wanted connected to the library, because these days, book libraries, yeah, there's a role for them, but they're really a lot about technology libraries and all of that. So you're smashing together all these things in one space. And it's important to then designate and organize them in such a way that they all function together. But in terms of architectural determinism, one incredible thing that has happened here is that there is a completely different interaction between faculty and students than at most other campuses. So think about if when you went to study in the afternoon, your faculty member was also studying in the same place and using the same resources, the same computer facilities, the same books, the same study areas, and there really is this kind of interaction, informal encounter that then creates a different kind of sense of community than happens at other universities. And in fact, this has been extremely successful at Delft. It completely changed the relationship between faculty and students and make them more a homogeneous community rather than a hierarchical community. So in this big space, there are faculty out there, they're doing their work, and they've got their little offices, and the students can go up and see the faculty member, and when they go down and get coffee, they're getting coffee at the same place the students are getting coffee. And when they're looking for a book, they're looking in the same place the students are looking for a book, and it's one community. And in terms of architectural determinism, that has really made a difference in how people relate to each other on that campus. There also is, rather than the books being in rows and rows and kind of peripheral to where you study, the books are right in the study space, and they're extremely visible there. And there's a kind of temptation to just go up and browse around and look at these books, which are now not invisible. But then you can, as you go up and you look at that big three-story book wall, then from that, there are little catwalks that go out to study spaces that are adjacent to those book areas. So it's very easy to pick up a book, take it out, browse, in a way that is not so much usual in university libraries. And there is this wonderful humanism at a smaller scale, great sensitivity to the way people use different places. I love it here in the big computer lab where, you know, you'd really like to have a view outside, but you also got to worry about reflections on the screen of your computer. So there's this little shroud right here that keeps the reflection from shining on your screen, but all the desks are turned at an angle, so you're always looking out the window, but not getting the deleterious light on your screen. Everywhere, the details are great. You know, again, it's a metal stair rail that needs to be durable and tough, but then when it gets to the point where you touch it, then it turns into wood, and the temperature is more the temperature of your hand, and it's a more humane interaction with personal physiognomy. Same way with the steps. You know, instead of them being metal, where you would hear the clank, 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 as every time somebody walked up the steps, here they're wood, where the noise is muffled, and it's not nearly as distracting to somebody who might be reading or studying in the big area. I will say, however, this is not a library that's meant to be quiet. It's, you know, people are interacting. It's more like a coffee shop, and it's less like what you think of as a normal library. There also is incredible humanism at a larger scale. Certainly, it's got all the convenience and accommodation of activity and range of people accommodated. It also has this periodic natural relief in spades because it kept all the green space. It didn't obliviate some of it by making the building there, and that actually is a really great place on a nice day when students gather and hang out and lay out in the sun in Holland when they have nice weather. It's extremely valuable, and this place is just mobbed when that happens. I happen to be taking these pictures in the winter time when it wasn't so full of people. It also has great meaning, this central tower, which is the skylight. Now that's the iconic center of the campus. It says that in the shape of that cone. This is the central thing. The library is a central building in the campus. It expresses that meaning and also expresses the meaning of, you know, we value outdoor space, we value nature. Those things are embedded in the building as well. So, again, a building really based on human factors, start to finish all the way through it. I'm just going to say a few words here about this very interesting library in a not-so-great neighborhood in London. This is called the Idea Store, and the architect is David Ajay, who's an African architect practicing in London. And this was kind of a tough neighborhood. And, you know, do you really have a branch library in a tough neighborhood? Are you going to get anybody in there? And that was kind of the worry. They had branch libraries in all the Tony neighborhoods in London. Felt a little bad about the fact they weren't servicing these lower income neighborhoods. So one of the things they decided is we're not even going to call it a library. We're going to call it an idea store. So the notion is that you encourage people to just come here and get ideas. And it's going to be, it's not even all about books. Honestly, there aren't that many books in this library. It's a more technology library. So they invest in this new kind of building in this low-income neighborhood. And they put it right at the place where the flea market is. And this is an area where there aren't like Tony shops. It's a lot of people who just bring in goods. A lot of secondhand goods are sold here. Really, really cheap consumer goods. This is where you go to get your detergent for your laundry, your towels, your just household goods. It's not a cute little European market, but it does sell fruits and vegetables and stuff like that, but it's just a market. And it replaces having more normal stores. And very entrepreneurial. Anybody can kind of set up a stall here. And that's where everybody does their shopping. And things are dirt cheap here. So that's where they decided to put the idea store, right smack up against the market, because tons of people go into this market. There are people there all hours of the day and night. And then from there, they really integrate the idea store with it. It kind of, you know, has an intersection with the market. It's open air to the market there. There's an escalator that takes you up to the upper floor or just bop right in on the lower floor. And then when you get inside the space, and there you can see that relationship to the market and kind of the arcade, and you're inside the idea store before you ever really know you're in there because it's part of the sidewalk. And then there's the escalators outdoors, and that takes you up in the building even before you know you're in there. And it isn't like a normal library where you have to go through security and they just, okay, it's open. Everybody can go in here. And then when you get inside, it's a real kind of casual environment, not stuffy at all. Lots and lots of views to the outside and to the neighborhood and then to the skyline of the central part of London in the other direction. There's cafes inside there. There's a few books, but not that many books. But it really is about getting access to computers because people in this neighborhood don't have home computers, and getting access to other kinds of technologies. A lot of kind of community services are in the freaking idea store, you know, that where you can get food stamps or you can get counseling, or those things are just integrated in there as well. This is really rethinking a common building type and saying, how do we make it more of service to the community? And that is human factors at its best. Rethinking, reinventing how these things work in a community. The final example I want us to look at is the Stata Center at MIT. And this is a building that, it's by Frank Gehry. I mean, we saw that video on Frank Gehry. We've seen a number of buildings by Frank Gehry. Frank Gehry is a badass form architect, right? He's a sculptor. He like crumples up paper and he makes these crazy ass buildings out of that. And I mean, that's what he's known for, right? And in a certain way, I think there's this sense he's such a famous architect. Isn't that really what architecture's about? Making badass, weird, out there forms. And we talked about that in the first part of the class. Now that we're getting toward the end here, I want to loop back and maybe let's look at Frank Gehry a slightly different way. So it actually happens that Frank Gehry had a big retrospective exhibit of his career. I think it was in 2002. About 2002. It was at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. We looked at that building. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright building right there on Central Park in New York. Very famous museum in New York. The entire building was devoted to Frank Gehry's work. So they took everything else out of the building. It's that spiral ramp that goes up, and then all the galleries are off that ramp. And so they took everything out of the building, and they made it all full of Frank Gehry's work. And they did it chronological. So you started at the beginning of his career at the bottom, and you just wound up and you saw everything he'd done. And it was great. He works in model a lot. So you see these little models of houses he did when he was 25 years old, and then you see bigger buildings, and he saves everything. He knew he was going to be famous, so he saved everything. And he has this huge warehouse of these models that he's built, and they're all out there in the Guggenheim Museum. And some of the models of the more recent buildings were enormous. They're like 25 feet long and 10 feet high. Well, incredible models. So it was quite a show. And so you went all the way up this, all the way up the spiral. At the very top, there's a new gallery that they appended to the Frank Lloyd Wright building that is a more regular gallery, but it's a big gallery. It's usually at the Guggenheim, this is where the star work is in this brand new gallery. And up there is the Stata Center. So this is 2002. This building is under construction at MIT. It's not finished. But instead of showing you a model of the building, the entire gallery is devoted to how this building works. Not what it looks like. There's not a single depiction of the way the building looks. There are depictions of the way it works. And it was showing you the process of programming this building. So Mr. Stata, who gave all the money, was this computer guy who had made a freaking fortune. He MIT grad, and he'd made a ton of money. And so he's building this new building, giving the money for this building, for computer science. But he is very, very involved in it. And he does several things. He insists on several things in the building. One is it needs to be an interdisciplinary building. Don't put all the computer nerds in there all by themselves. So neuroscience, some neuroscience people are in this building. Some linguistics people are in this building. So it's a kind of interdisciplinary building, not just computer science, but significantly computer science. And then he said, you've got to use Frank Gehry as the architect. He was insistent. He was given, I don't know, $50 million, $100 million, something like that. And he said, you've got to use Frank Gehry as the architect. And then the other thing is when the thing began to go over budget, he said, I'll cover it. So they were a little worried. We get Frank Gehry in here and it goes over budget, you know, that could be a bad thing. And he said, fine, I'll cover it. And he did. So this room at the top of the Guggenheim is about programming this building, figuring out how do we designate and organize uses in this building? And Mr. Stata was all about getting these nerds to collaborate with each other. So the very worst thing about computer science majors is they tend to just put on the blinders and work all by themselves. And he said, that's not how great breakthroughs occur in computer science. It's a collaborative field. It needs people. I mean, for one thing, you can't write all the software for a complex program by yourself. It's got to be done by teams of people. And they've got to be able to communicate with each other in order to produce a good product. So how do we get these nerds working with each other? And the building was very much seen as a vehicle for educating computer science people to work with each other. So that whole room was full of little diagrams, and it showed pictures of little workshop sessions they had with the students and with the faculty, and trying to figure out how to make this a truly collaborative environment. So at MIT, in the older part of the campus, there is this very famous long corridor that goes through the original building. And it's just maybe 10, 12 feet wide. It's famous among MIT students. It's just like this endless corridor. And it's good because the Boston winters are really tough, and it's a way to get from one side of the campus to the other without inclement weather being a deterrent. But Frank Gehry took a different twist on it. He made this building a long, skinny passageway that goes through it, but instead of it being this deadly dull uniform corridor, it's this lively interactive street where all these things occur off of it. And that's in that programming that was up in the Guggenheim building, was this idea of this passageway where people would move from one part of the campus to the other through the Stata Center, but along it would be all of these different activities. So as you move along that passageway where we're seeing in these pictures, this is then it's not just the inside, but it's the outside. So you're also seeing a reflection of those functions, like it's an amphitheater over here, so classes could be held outside. Also that you would reflect all the functions of the building on the exterior of the building. So a little conference room where people are gathering together and having this little collaborative session, that would be celebrated in this little yellow form that shows that. Each of these cranky, weird shapes or forms, they actually reflect a function on the inside. And you can read very distinctly what's going on the inside from looking at each piece on the outside. That's another one of these little workshop rooms on the inside, made of a different material and having its own kind of role within the larger agglomeration of forms. Now, when you get on the street on the inside, then you're seeing an interior experience of all of those interesting agglomerations of things that you were seeing on the outside. So you enter here on the left, you move along that street, there's skylights and lots of things happening architecturally along the way, lots of pieces of art, there's exhibit things, there's posters with, you know, areas where they can just post notices, and zillions of signs of human presence here. You're seeing a kind of externalization of what the computer science department is doing along that street. And then there are things like, that's a big blackboard. And here are two kind of nerdy faculty members. And later on that morning when I was there, they'd taken out the chalk and they were marking on that blackboard and putting some formulas up there and having a discussion over their coffee. And that's externalized. So it gives a place for those working relationships to be there right in the public on the street. And people can see that kind of collaboration going on. Lots of little nooks and crannies and places to sit along that street. And then there is, of course, there's a library, a little branch library that's there where you can check out books and return books. There's a whole fitness center that's there. So you see, Pillsbury Doughboy nerds, kind of trying to work it off there. And then some fit ones too, but, it's an interesting gym right in the middle of the computer science department. And that was, a little anachronistic, not something you'd expect, but that was in the programming. That's a way we can get people to socialize with each other, put the gym right there in the middle of the building and make it extremely visible right there on the street. And then, of course, there's the coffee shop and things like that along there, and there's a more sit-down cafe restaurant along that street as well. And just all the way along it, it's a fantastic place to just dip in, dip out, hang out. Very visible, very social kind of space. And unlike any other space anywhere on the MIT campus. So immediately, everyone wants to hang out in the Seda Center. And it got to be a very, very popular place very quickly. So when I was in Boston several weeks ago, I was there with my son and his wife. And we went over to the Seda Center, and this was a Saturday, and things were hopping at the Seda Center on a Saturday. Another time I was there, Ted Kennedy was giving a talk at MIT, and where did they have Ted Kennedy giving a talk? Not in some auditorium somewhere. They just had him perched on one of these stair landings, and he's giving a talk to 500 people along that street in the Seda Center, and it was amazing. And it was a great event. All of this making a sense of community and a sense of activity and a sense of collaboration and a sense of communication right there in that computer science building. And that was the vision that Mr. Seda had in mind when he gave the money for the building. And that was very much embodied by Frank Gehry in the design of it. So I was, I'm an MIT alum, and I was on a advisory committee at MIT for 10 years, and went there every year for these advisory meetings. And it was an opportunity to get to know the guy who was the president at the time and the provost. And so one time at one of these meetings, I was having dinner with the provost, one of these big rubber chicken dinners that they have at those kind of occasions. And so I'm sitting by him, and it was maybe, three or four years after the Stata Center had been completed. And they'd actually done two buildings, big buildings on the campus, big academic buildings, at about the same time. They did the Stata Center for Computer Science, and they did a building for Brain and Cognitive Science. And they were right across the street from each other. They were both huge buildings. They were both really, really nicely funded, important buildings for the UT campus. And the provost said, in both of these buildings, we had the goal of getting scientists to interact with each other. In Brain and Cognitive Science, we had the same problems as were identified in computer science. We need more collaboration. We need people to communicate more with each other. We don't need them holed up in their labs and isolated from each other. And he said, in both of these cases, in the Stater Center and in Brain and Cognitive Science, we asked the architects to make an environment that's going to encourage collaboration. He said, in both cases, all the way through the design process, the architects are talking about this, and they're saying, yes, we're designing this space, it's going to do it. In the Stata Center, it was this wonderful, lively street, and in the case of Brain and Cognitive Science, it was a big atrium. He said, in the end, the Stata Center freaking totally worked. It did everything we asked the architects for it to do. We love that building. It works extremely well. Now, the roof leaks like a sieve, and there were some technical problems with the building because it's such a crazy-ass form. But the problem was that in Brain and Cognitive Science, it did not work. They had a big atrium there, but it just wasn't arranged in such a way that people could come to the building, take the elevator up to their lab, do their work all day, and never pass through the atrium. And so they did. And they tended to be in their isolated labs like they always had been. It did not arrange spaces. It did not place activities in such a way that it really succeeded in creating this collaborative environment. And he said, now after the fact, I can see exactly the design moves that made that happen at Stata and the mistakes the architects made because they just didn't have the skills in creating that kind of collaborative environment that happened in the Brain and Cognitive Science building. These are important architectural skills that have to do with human factors. And a point I'm making here is that Frank Gehry, he's a badass form guy, but he also is a really good architect. He knows how to handle human factors, and he knows how to make buildings that accomplish social as well as aesthetic goals. As you move through this building all over, you're constantly looking into a little conference room and seeing activity going on there, looking down into people's labs and workspaces. There's the ability for people to express themselves, and have their travels and have their families and all of that be there. I love the work environments here. They're like total workshops, and they are not tidy. They're messy workshop spaces. There's none of this. Everybody needs to keep a clean desk, and it's got to be very precise and, photographable. They're just workshops, and they really do look like lively, amazing places where great ideas happen and people collaborate, and it's a cool place. So the very first time I saw this building after it was finished, one of the guys in computer science gave me a really great tour of the building, up, down, around, everywhere. Really great tour, all the way into very secure spaces because some of them are pretty secure. So then he and I were going down the elevator at the end of this tour, and I was saying goodbye to him and thanking him and I appreciate the time you took, blah, 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 blah. Riding down on the elevator with us was one of these Pillsbury Doughboy graduate students. This guy who's like super plump and trying to grow a beard, not really getting there yet. Just nerd. Oh my God, super nerd. Like only MIT can grow. Oh, unbelievable. The complete stereotype. So we get off the elevator. My tour guide leaves me, and this guy comes up and says,
you want me to show you my place? And so I said, oh, yeah, that would be kind of interesting to hear his perspective on it. He's a user. He lives in this building. You know, he's a grad student. Yeah, show me your place. So we go back up in the elevator, and on the left here, that's his lab. And he was so proud of that place. It's just a little collaborative, almost like a living room right there. So they all have their workspace, but they have this place where there are nice soft chairs, and there's a kitchenette, and this is where they collaborate. And he's telling me, you know, what a great place it is and how, you know, I see people from all the different labs, and we run into each other, and you know, he's affirming all the things I've been telling you here. But it was so great to see him so proud of his place. He wanted to show that off to me. He wanted to show me what a cool lab he had and how it worked for him. So, yeah, badass, crazy Frank Gehry form, but that's not the only thing to this building. Don't let anyone tell you that's what architecture is about and it stops there. No, no, no. The real success of the Stata Center is that it really did accomplish this new learning environment that stimulated people to work in a different way and to see a different way of collaborating with each other. And that's kind of human factors at its best. Okay, so Twitter card question for today. I want you to think of an environment that you would deem to be extremely successful holistically on human factors. And just describe very briefly to me, is that important? What is the importance? What kind of contribution does that make?